It's the Killer Energy Shot edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, rogue planets, Ireland's abortion dilemma kills, women's secular issue, and do energy drinks kill? And this week, special guest Freethinker, Stephanie Van Dyke, UBC's own Freethinkers Club president. Let's begin episode 190.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross sword for politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of spark stuff. We are aware of the cosmos and know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others. We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your free thinking historian.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher.
And this is Stephanie Van Dyke, the president of UBC Freethinkers.
Oh my God, Ethan, it's the end of the world. I can't believe it. You know, last week we were talking about the impending extinction of coffee. Well, this week it's even worse. It's the end of the Twinkie. It appears that Hostess, the producer of the Twinkie, famed food for a post-apocalyptic world on which the survivors of the nuclear holocaust, of course the cockroaches, were expected to feast upon the remains of the hubris human society. Well, Hostess apparently is trying to shut down, so that's the end of the Twinkie for good. 2012 may be the end of the world after all. Let's ask our guest thinker, Stephanie Van Dyke, what she thinks. But first, who the hell are you and what are you doing here?
I am the president of the UBC Freethinkers, which is UBC's only skeptical and secular-focused student club. I'm here because I want to talk about skeptical issues and also about my club.
Excellent. Well, actually, Stephanie has been on the show before in the past, so this is your second time on the show.
Correct. Second time.
Excellent. Fantastic. Well, so since you're here, Stephanie, why don't we start off with the UBC Freethinkers. What are they up to? What's going on? You know, how are we doing here on the campus with regards to secular skeptic stuff?
Things are good on campus. We have a number of really, really dedicated students who are involved in our club, and we've been doing some really cool events this year. We have something coming up tomorrow, actually, which I'm really looking forward to. It's a event on end-of-life issues at 5 p.m. in Swing Space. We've got a bunch of different experts coming in to talk about these issues and have a bit of a Q&A and hopefully some lively debate. But you know how it is on UBC campus. The major issue we always face is that many students live in Burnaby or Richmond, and it's hard to organize events that everyone can get out to. So that's something we continually work on.
I bet you that UBC probably is one of the few universities where the majority of its students don't actually live in the university's residential areas.
In the city to which the university actually belongs to.
Well, I mean, yeah, most people who live here are, you know, uppity yuppies and stuff who don't actually go to this campus. That's interesting.
Except for our wonderful alumni and donors, and we appreciate that. CITR is a volunteer organization that appreciates donations because it is a community service. Ethan.
Yes. Well, actually, Stephanie, you mentioned your upcoming event. You had one a couple days ago, a discussion of women and women's issues in the secular movement. I was at this event. It was actually pretty interesting. Great discussions came up. How has the club sort of waded into what has become a very sort of dicey and heated debate within the larger community?
It is a very heated debate within the larger community. But I think I feel very fortunate in the fact that our club has managed to treat this issue with kindness. We have a lot of women on our leadership team, and we have for a very long time. And so I think we have a pretty intelligent member base who aren't too concerned about, you know, overrepresentation of women or who say really stupid things about women a lot. It's been a good experience, I think, overall.
For those people who may not be, you know, in the bubble that we are, what exactly are these particular issues and how is it manifested or not manifested at the UBC Club? So when we talk about women's issues and secularism and all that, from your point of view and from what you've been seeing, What does that mean for those people who, again, may not be as up on the debate as we are?
Yeah, I think there is a bit of a perception that sometimes skepticism has been in the past or still is a bit of a boys' club. And attempts to address this or remedy this have been met with varying levels of resistance, perhaps too much resistance, which makes the women who want to be involved in skepticism a little bit angry. And it gets heated pretty quickly. We're fortunate because we have a lot of women who are involved in our group, and so we are able to, I think, include women and not really worry about it too much. But I recognize that that's not true generally. I was involved in other clubs when I've been spent time in Ontario at different universities, and they have a real paucity of women in their clubs, and that's concerning.
Well, I mean, the absence of women in the movement is obviously a big issue. The other concern is that when they are involved, they face harassment, discrimination, and other unfortunate behavior. Has the club, I mean, I hope not now that doesn't happen in the club right now, but have you heard of this sort of thing happening within other campus clubs? Or do you know, is there any kind of exception to the rule that perhaps the Freethinkers enjoy? Or
it does happen in other campus clubs. I've experienced it in other campus clubs. And to some extent, I think that's something that people, women especially, can face anywhere. I'm a computer science major. I know that this is not something that is unique in any way to secularism. But I think the fact that one of the benefits is that UBC Freethinkers, I think this is our third year now with a woman as the president and other women on our executive team, and really, really educated and smart men who know about these issues well and deeply, also on the executive team. So I feel like we have been lucky and able to create a space that is safe and welcoming for lots of different sorts of people. That's the dream anyways. That's what I want to believe.
So, you know, that would lead to maybe a follow-up area in this, is that if there doesn't seem to be an issue as far as gender equality at the UBC Freethinkers Club, what about the other angle that a lot of this debate has been going on, is that the focus shouldn't be on so much, you know, homeopathy or atheism or that, but that it should be taking on more social issues, so that, great, you know, there's been, like, you know, a number of women presidents at the UBC Freethinkers Club, but, you know, we have a premier who is a female, and sometimes she gets subjugated to sexist kind of comments, and that we live in a society in general that is definitely biased towards one gender than the other. Should secularism move to take on these issues, or should it sit back and worry about more core areas of interest?
I mean, my pet issues all revolve around sexuality and gender, and I'm sort of the opinion that there are not enough activists in the world, so whoever wants to work on issues should work on them. And I'm not going to sit here and say, oh, we are wasting our time on issues of homeopathy, because clearly there's a problem there. But on the other hand, if I have people come to me and say, we want to do this cool thing about regarding to LGBT issues or to gender issues or to social justice issues, then I will say awesome, because realistically, we need all the help we can get in fighting for a more skeptical place.
Oh, well said. Well, let's go on to our first news segment here on the show. Unfortunately, this is another sad example of the harm of religious dogma. By now, you've probably heard of the death of Savita Halappanavar. Savita was a dentist who lived in Galloway, Ireland, and was 17 weeks pregnant. She went to the hospital after experiencing back pains and found out that she was miscarrying. After some time in agonizing pain, she asked for the pregnancy to be terminated. She was refused because, quote, because the fetal heartbeat is still present and they were told this is a Catholic country. She had to suffer through 2.5 more days of agony until the fetus died and was removed. Savita was then moved to high-intensity care, where she later died of septicemia. Now, what moves us beyond the realm of terrible tragedy is the statements from Savita's husband, Praveen, who said that when they learned the baby was dying as a result of the miscarriage, and after being informed that there was nothing they could do to save the baby, Savita asked for an abortion. The hospital staff refused, saying the baby would die naturally within a few hours. That didn't happen, though. The trauma continued for days, and even when Savita became critically ill, her life was in danger, they still refused to abort the pregnancy. Now, because of Ireland's anti-abortion laws, two lives were lost and a family was destroyed because of all of this. So not only is this about abortion being illegal in Ireland, it's also illegal for doctors to tell their patients about abortion options in other countries. It's illegal for people to travel to another country for an abortion. And the only way an abortion is legal in Ireland is if it's necessary to save the mother's life. However, the intentional vague wording of these laws keep doctors from administering abortions, even in this example case, when they really should have done one to save this woman's life.
Well, and actually, it's even more complicated in a way, because Ireland's constitution has, well, sort of innate contradictions built into it. In the 1980s, they passed the Eighth Amendment. Actually, I'm quite amazed how easy it is to amend the Irish Constitution, but that's another thing. That essentially put the unborn, quote, child's life on an equal footing with the mother. So as you've sort of pointed out, until the unborn child, if you can use that term, is dead, it is the same as if you had killed someone else according to the Constitution. But they had this very interesting case. I shouldn't say interesting. They had a very sad case. Interesting makes it sound bad. Anyhow, they had this case, it's called X case, where a 14-year-old girl was made pregnant when she was raped by her friend's father. The Irish Supreme Court then ruled that it was unconstitutional to deny her the right to an abortion because she was suicidal, and that put her life directly in case. Although, of course, she was only allowed to go to another country, England, to get the abortion. I think it was England. This, of course, was quickly followed up by a couple of constitutional amendments in 1992 that decriminalized the travel to procure an abortion. So up until then, even if you wanted to leave the country to get an abortion, it was overtly denied by the Constitution. And the right of women to even know that an abortion was an option was, again, in the was part of the Constitution. But this had removed the constitutional barriers to that. That being said, although they changed the Constitution, they never actually got around to changing the laws. And in an odd sort of way, a successive number of very conservative governments have been very resistant to change the laws, even though the attitude of the country has changed.
Yeah. Well, also, in 2010, the European Court of Human Rights demanded Ireland clarify the status of abortion in Irish law. However, the governments of Ireland have repeatedly dragged their feet on this, and they're really in no hurry to change this. Now, I mean, we can pretty directly tie the abortion laws to Ireland to the nation being a stalwart sort of Catholic and Christian nation. And, you know, the regressive views of the Catholic Church on abortion have been well documented. We don't have to really rehash them here. The implication of these abortion laws is an affront on the autonomy of women in Ireland and access to medical treatment that the rest of the population would normally enjoy. And, I mean, it's just sort of adding insult to injury that the hospital itself was a, quote, Catholic hospital, as if, you know, Catholics have different bodies than Protestants or something. Like, it's just insult to injury on top of all of that. Now, getting back to the situation in Ireland, Savita's death has sparked international outrage and protests in Dublin. In fact, one Indian newspaper went so far as to suggest that the hospital murdered Savita. Now, large protests, apparently occurring twice in the span of 3 days in Dublin, have reignited the debate on abortion, and according to some reports, have pushed public opinion to having a more liberal view of abortion, seeking to clarify these laws, liberalize them a little bit. Now, to address the criticism, Ireland has announced a fact-finding investigation to look into the abortion laws, that sort of thing. The reality is, though, that any review will take months, and since the Irish government is in no hurry to pass these laws, you know, it's basically letting it sort of simmer, and hopefully for them, it's just going to go away, but I think it's up to secularists to make sure it doesn't go away.
Well, you know, and this is a very classic maneuver by any government, is whenever you get news you don't want, you do a study on it, and you hope by the time the study comes out, everyone's kind of forgotten what the original issue, and you can just sort of brush it under the carpet. But, and forgive me, I'm going to play devil's advocate here for a moment. You have framed this as a theological debate, and I'm not doubting that that is a very strong argument here. But if you were, I mean, you can be an atheist and believe that life begins at the moment of conception or at some, I mean, 17 weeks is a fair bit of way along in the route of that. And if you think that, you know, it is a life with rights, it does seem to be consistent to say, well, until the heart is dead, there's nothing we can do about it. In the same way that we have debates about euthanasia that, you know, okay, we know this person's going to die, but they're not there yet. We just don't sort of terminate them early, just sort of because. So in that sense, I think you can kind of make the argument that even if this wasn't a Catholic country, there still may be the debate there. And I think that also plays into the idea, because from what I understand from a lot of the public polling and that sort of thing, and the fact that they had two constitutional amendments that had failed that attempted to restrict abortion rights, that the majority of people are on favor for loosening it up, but it is the conscience, in quotes, of the actual leaders that are doing that. And, I mean, part of it may be, you know, they owe favors to the Catholic Church, or again, they may be men of conviction. I mean, it's one of the weird areas where I disagree with you strongly, but there is a consistency in your belief that I have to kind of respect.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to push back on that a little bit, because if her husband was told that the child was dying and that there was no way to save it, if that was the medical opinion of the doctors, then her death was completely unnecessary in every way. Because even if you believe that life begins at conception and that this baby's life was important, it was already gone. And her life still could have been saved. I think this is one of those cases that is almost as clear-cut as an abortion case ever gets.
Fair enough. I mean, I think that, yes, Dawn is right. You can have, you know, say an atheist state that's anti-abortion. But given what we know about Ireland's history and the influence of the Catholic Church in that country, I mean, it's really, I think it is a kind of a stretch to say that there's not some religious...
playing devil's advocate.
Fair enough.
So
yes.
I'm not arguing that so much, but there is a consistency, and I'm going to push back against Stephanie, is let's again do the hypothetical. There's a person who has cancer, and they've got 6 months to live, or 6 weeks, or 6 days, or even 6 hours to live. And if you just kill them, again, that I don't know what other word you would use, right? Then to save someone else's life, knowing that there's a risk, and it was only a risk, because, I mean, there's a certain degree where they might have been able to reduce the, the suffering of the mother in this case, because they knew she was suffering. But there was not no necessity that she would get septicemia and die as a result of that. That may have been plausible, probable even, but it was not necessary. Whereas, again, if you accept the idea, and I don't personally, but again, playing devil's advocate here, that at 6 weeks or 10 weeks, it is alive as a human being, and therefore, in your belief system, has the same rights as a human. The fact that you know it's going to be dead in a day or an hour doesn't change the fact that it happens to be in somebody versus not in somebody, if, again, you run with the assumption that life begins at day X.
Oh, that's totally fair enough. But I think that, from my understanding, and I'm not a medical doctor, but my understanding is that the idea that miscarriage is somehow low risk is not one that's true. I think there's always a large amount of risk there, especially in pregnancies that are further along. And realistically, this is just a deeply tragic thing on a million different levels.
And I think that if it had happened in 100 other countries, she'd be alive. And it would not have been a big issue. Even in the States, this would not have happened in most of the states.
True. And if it had happened in 100 other countries, we wouldn't have even heard about it.
Yeah. Well, let's go to a commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker. I'll be back with more after this.
I imagined what it would be like to be a wizard. And then I pretended and acted in that way on the day.
Studies show that 9 out of 10 wizards prefer CITR 101.9 FM.
If we were to draw a graph of my process, of my method, something like this, Sir Ian, action. Wizard, you shall not pass! Cut! Sir Ian.
the best tool ever devised for understanding how the world.
To subscribe to the Radio Freethinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes, subscribe via iTunes or at radiofreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com. Understanding empowers you.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the Main Street area at
Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear, Flaming Angels Boutique, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, Red Cat Records, the Regional Assembly of Text, RX Comics, Temple of the Modern Girl, and the Wallflower Modern Diner.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To learn more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus or check us out online at citr.ca.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker here on CITR. So guys, have you heard of the planet CFBDSIR2149?
No.
Wasn't that one of the major actors in the new Star Wars 7 coming up? Wasn't he the father of C-3PO?
Maybe.
Okay.
But, well, I guess you haven't then. So get ready to memorize that name because it's one of the coolest astronomical findings of the year. CFBDSIR2149 is a rogue planet. That's right. And what is a rogue planet, you ask? Well, it's a planet that doesn't orbit a star. That's right. It just floats out there in the cosmos like some sort of planetary hipster. Not only that, this is maybe the closest example of a rogue planet we've ever seen. So to quote Phil Plait, it was discovered by astronomers surveying a small clot of stars located just about 75 light years from Earth. This cluster, called AB Doradus, is a group of about 30 stars that probably form together and are still moving through space together, like a swarm of bugs. Using various measurements of the stars themselves, astronomers have determined that the stars are young, less than 200 million years old for sure, and possibly only a tenth that age. That may sound ancient, but compare that to the sun's age of 4.6 billion years, and you see that AB Dor stars are actually pretty springly. So, they probed this cluster with an infrared telescope, and they found this rogue planet. The planet is quite big, about 4 to 7 times the size of Jupiter, and it's about 450 degrees Celsius, or 850 degrees Fahrenheit. So you might wonder, well, could this be just another, you know, small star? It's still actually way too small to be even like a brown dwarf. And it's actually still way too cold to be a brown dwarf. So it's actually, surprisingly, well within the definition of a planet.
One of the things actually I thought was funny when I was looking into this in the SDS, and I'm sorry, I didn't know the name, but I have heard about this rogue. Apparently it's a planet that, you know, got pissed off with its parents and wanted to join the circus, but discovered there is no circus in space because no one hears you laugh. Yeah,
okay.
But no, apparently, like, even brown dwarfs, the reason why that they're called a star, as opposed to just a very, like, a failed star, which is sometimes they are, is they actually do have a period where they do burn. I mean, they're not enough to burn regular hydrogen, but they do get big enough to actually burn deuterium, which is rare in the planet, but there's some in there. So even a brown dwarf or the quote-unquote failed star for a brief period of time is actually a real star, whereas this one, although it's huge, never actually has enough to generate heat on its own, other than things like a bit from gravity and from radioactive decay and leftover heat from its formation, which is why we see it and it still seems so hot. It's one of the reasons why we know it's where it is and how old it is because of how cold relative to the stars that it's believed to be associated with.
Yeah, absolutely. CFBDSIR2149, I love saying that. It's just floating out there, and it makes it easy to spot because there's no star to drown out. So to quote Phil again, it's not 100% certain that this is in fact a rogue planet. There's a small chance that it's not part of the cluster. It's actually a background star located much further away, but it only appears to be sitting in the cluster you'd see a distant house connected, to a street, but you're just seeing it between two other houses from a distance. So we could have that situation here, but he says that there's an 85% chance this really is a rogue planet.
Where does he get 85 from?
He must have some kind of giant calculator.
Okay. One of those crazy eight balls.
Yeah.
85% certainty.
Yeah.
His magical astronomy brain.
So even though this isn't the first rogue planet we've ever found, this is much closer than any of them that we've ever seen. And this means we may actually be able to study this one and learn a lot more about planets and how stars affect their development. And I think that's sort of the most interesting question here. Without a star, what is this planet like? I mean, could there be any chance of life on it? What would the conditions be like? You know, what would its one season be like? I mean, you know, because it doesn't have a planet to heat or cool it.
Well, so I'm gonna burst your bubble a little bit here, Ethan. I'm sorry. So there is a lot we can learn from it, right? Because again, because it doesn't have a star anywhere near it, we can actually look at its atmosphere in a lot more detail than we can. We actually see it, whereas a lot of the other planets before, we had to imply that they were there because of things like gravitational lensing and that sort of thing. But this is a gas giant, or from all expectations, it has to be a gas giant. So there is no surface there. It is 400 some odd degrees. And again, based on all the other planets we know about with life on them, i.e. Earth, 400 degrees is a little hot for life to begin on. So I doubt we're going to be doing any research into this directly to say, oh, I wonder if there are aliens on this planet.
Yeah, I remember an episode of Cosmos where Carl Sagan was talking about the possibility of atmospheric-based life forms like floating around in Jupiter.
The gas giants on gas giants.
Yeah. So I don't know.
No, well, hope springs eternal.
Fair enough.
Does the UBC Free Thinkers Club have an official opinion on this particular astronomical event?
I think our official opinion is that Phil Plait is awesome. And also, I would watch that sci-fi movie about gas giants on gas giants. I think that sounds like a lot of fun.
Yes, I think it's called El Burrito, the planet. Sorry, the gas giant.
Yeah, okay. Well, let's go for another commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker. We'll be back with more after this.
Then there's the utter misery that is college radio, where they apparently just let any bewildered freshman wander into the booth and try to run a radio station. Campus Outreach is looking for... Hang on. College radio can pretty much be summed up in five words.
CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts downtown at
212 Productions, Beat Street Records, Blim, Dream Apparel, The Fall Tattooing, The Kiss Store, Heart and Soul Clothing Inc., Hits Boutique, Pacific Cinematheque, Scratch Records, Vinyl Records, Woo Vintage Clothing, and Zoo Shop.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To learn more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus or check us out online at citr.ca.
I'm this dot standing on a planet. Really, I'm just a speck compared with a star.
Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Free Thinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Free Thinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
And we're back. So, do energy drinks kill? Okay, a number of our listeners may have been reading and watching news reports about how kids have been dropping like flies because they drank a Monster energy drink. Well, when I first read about this, this latest string of death by supplements, my first reaction was, Here we go again, worrying about a potential problem while ignoring sort of real problems. For example, I don't know if you know, but there was another case of E. coli reported out of the XL meatpacking plant recently. Sorry. To emphasize the evilness. So the stories have been based upon a press release by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, that was investigating about 92 complaints about energy drinks. Five-hour Energy, Monster, and Rockstar, to be exact. Now, technically, of course, five-hour energy drink isn't a drink. It's actually a shot, so that confuses things a little bit. And of those complaints, there were like 15 fatalities. Although, oddly enough, almost every report that I was reading only mentioned 13 of them, which seemed a little weird. But so, again, I was about to sort of dismiss this as another sort of, you know, news clatter. But, you know, I'm a skeptic, and sometimes it's tedious, but as a good skeptic, I thought, okay, I'll investigate to see what's there. So the first thing I did is I looked at the implicit claim that caffeine can be toxic, and enough so to kill. Well, as it turns out, yes, caffeine in sufficient quantities can kill. Of course, the next thought that came to me, well, anything in sufficient quantities can kill, but are they realistic amounts? Well, your average cup of coffee contains about 100 to 125 milligrams of caffeine. The amount advertised on your typical energy drink, like Monster drink, is about 1,000. And the amount in sort of the pep supplements are like 5-hour energy shot, are about 2,000 milligrams. Now, the LD50 for caffeine is 175 milligrams per kilogram. Now, you're sitting there saying, what the heck is the LD50? The LD50 is the amount of caffeine needed to result in a 55% death rate in rats or similar test subjects. It's sort of treated as the amount that will likely kill you if you had it. For the average person weighing about 75 kilograms or 165 pounds, for caffeine to become toxic, you would need to, you would need to consume about 13,000 milligrams of caffeine for it to become toxic. That amounts to roughly 130 cups of coffee, 13 cans of energy drink, or 7 energy shots.
Is there a time limit for this as well? Like, it has to be within a certain hour or something? Or can you metabolize that over the course of a day?
That is while it is bioactive in your system. And as you write, caffeine has a half-life in your system of, I think, about 9 hours. So within that sort of period of time.
Right.
So not so much that you have to worry about if you have 130 cups a day. Although, if you do have 130 cups a day, I think you should seek treatment.
Well, maybe I'm just thinking someone like on like NORAD, 24-hour missile watch or something, you know, drinking coffee after coffee.
Students during exam period doing energy shots.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, that goes into the thing. So it seems unlikely you could actually drink that much coffee. And I think it would actually kind of be pushing it to actually have the energy drinks. But the energy shots, well, that actually seems to be quite plausible. I mean, they're not much to drink, and they... you can wolf them down quite good. So then I thought, okay, well, so there does seem to be something there. So let's go take a look at the reported cases. So I went to the FDA's website. And, of course, a number of the reports are sort of non-specific, you know, sort of lack of sleep, weight loss, fear was one of them. But that said, there were a number that had things like, you know, an increased heart rate, arrhythmia, and even convulsions. And these actually are symptoms of caffeine poisoning. There were a lot of what I would call, I don't know, noise in some of the reports. In the cases resulting in death, other factors seem to be more contributory, sort of like head injury, pneumonia, and one of the reports had, quote, completed suicide. I'm not exactly sure how the caffeine played in that, but that said, though, there were actually correlations with myocardial infarction, which is mispronounced, but a heart attack. With 5-hour energy shot. And like I say, this seem to be quite good correlation between the two. Any thoughts?
So, I mean, we're talking about someone drinking like less than 7, but more than like, say, 4 energy of these shots, right? I mean, like keeling over. I've never actually had one of these before, so I really have no way to sort of imagine in my head what kind of energy boost you would get from this sort of thing.
Well, I'm so glad you brought that up, because Ethan, I brought in for all us here a bunch of energy shots, so I figure I brought 24. We could either split them up equally or just have you drink them all right away. Would you be willing to sacrifice your own life?
I had a coffee already, so I don't want to exceed my caffeine limit for the day.
Well, you know, act so to go with where I think you're going with that, in the reports, you know, they had sort of symptoms, they had sort of outcomes, and they had sort of, you know, what drink was related to this, but they didn't actually give a dosage. So as far as we know from the FDA reports, these people may have been claiming damage from one drink or 100 drinks. And we don't know what time frame, because again, some of the reports make mention that the person came in, then they suffered, you know, increased heart palpitations, pneumonia, convulsions, and then death. Did this happen in a 1 hour time frame, or was this like a week long stay? And at the end of the stay, they died. And, you know, so there was a number of things.
Well, I mean, one aspect to this is what were they doing too? Because, you know, I used to play in a beer league hockey team, and I had teammates who would chug down like 3 cans of Red Bull before playing a game of hockey. If they keel over in the game, is it because they're playing hockey, which is an incredibly physically exertive sport, or is it because they drank 3 cans of Red Bull, right? What are they doing immediately after drinking all this?
Well, actually, before we go there, because it's even more confusing than you think it is, Ethan, and you do think it's confusing.
I do think it is confusing.
So now there are actually some other confounding factors and actually incorrect assumptions to some of this. First is actually the amount of caffeine that these drinks have is not always clearly stated. They label the caffeine portion quite often as part of a combination of stimulating substances that include things like ginger and, oh, it's another G word, and I can't remember
ginseng?
What it is. Ginseng, thank you. But mainly, most of them rely upon something called taurine, and actually it's not caffeine. So taurine itself is a, quote, natural substance, and I put that in there because, I mean, caffeine, I guess, is natural. It comes from plants, but this is actually produced in our own bodies, and it's found in things like meat and fish. We normally get about 400 milligrams of taurine from our diet. There doesn't seem to be an LD50 number for taurine, so it seems to be not fatal at any rational level, although I imagine if they put 100 tons on your chest, you might suffocate to death. Because it's normally produced by the body, any excess of taurine is actually excreted by the kidneys as part of its natural function. So as often said about megadosing of vitamin C, most of what you get in the energy drink, you literally piss away. Now, most energy drinks that I researched did have actually caffeine numbers and taurine numbers, and the caffeine numbers came in at about 200 to 400 milligrams, so like a couple of shots of coffee, but not crazy. But the taurine levels were up to 1,000 milligrams. Now, based on what we've already learned, you'd still need to drink about 40 cans or so to reach toxic levels of caffeine. And if taurine doesn't have a toxic level, again, there seems to be a bit of a disconnect there. That said, from the labeling of the energy shot, which claims 200 milligrams of stimulant, there's no way for me to know if the 5-hour energy shot contains 150 milligrams of taurine and 50 grams of caffeine, or the reverse. So at least we have one example of here where we actually need some better regulation so that we actually know what's in here. Because for, again, from what research we did, it is really important to know, is it caffeine or taurine? Caffeine can be fatal. Taurine, probably not so. Do you guys think that has anything to do with anything?
Well, I mean, what about like kidney failure from sorting out all that excess taurine?
Yeah, no, it potentially. You know, although, of course, like, again, I would equate to something like vitamin C, where I haven't heard of any kidney-related deaths from megadosing of that. But if you're someone who has kidney issues, you know, your ability to strike out, and that actually leads to another confounding factor, which is something that's quite interesting.
Do tell, Don.
I will. So one of the other confounding factors, and it's actually one that's often reported with the press, it's one government agencies always stress, and actually, to be fair, even the producers of these drinks often mention on their own products, is you're not supposed to mix these with alcohol.
Ooh.
Now, for some reason, kids will be kids, and they often quite mix the two, and I don't know why. I mean, pot should be enough for you to mix with alcohol, but if you wanted the energy drinks, actually, no, to be fair, in a lot of the research that I've read about and I saw, one thing these energy drinks actually do is they suppress our subjective ability to judge sobriety, i.e. we feel less drunk than we really are. So, and feels important here, because although we don't feel drunk, we are actually intoxicated, and the levels of alcohol in our system are elevated. This means that people who mix the two are more likely to drink more, thus increasing their chances of alcohol poisoning, as well as injuring themselves because, well, they're just plain drunk and they don't think they're drunk. Oh, I can drive the car. Crash. Another factor of alcohol is dehydration. This will not only amplify the toxic effects of caffeine, but as Ethan sort of pointed out, it reduces our kidneys' ability to purge excess amounts of taurine, because as you dehydrate, your body doesn't want to filter out anything. It wants to keep a hold of all its water. With the boost of believed energy, partygoers are also much more likely to push their physical limits. And, you know, so you're out there and you're dancing on the floor and you're going to dance a lot longer than you would have perhaps than if you didn't have these energy drinks mixed in with the alcohol. That's perspiring more, that's increasing the dehydration. And of course, let's not forget either that to this menagerie, we can include at least in a number of these cases, other intoxicants like ecstasy, Special K, etc., which again will further sort of stress the body. And it is interesting to note that the vast majority of the symptoms mentioned in the reports correlate with dehydration, including death due to heart attack. So, drink anyone?
Well, you know, it's interesting because listening to you talk about this, I mean, the key issue here appears to be labeling is ultimately the issue at stake. Because if we assume that these energy drinks contain mega doses of caffeine, well, we're basing it on an assumption. We don't know for sure until they tell us what's really in their drinks.
And more dangerously, people assuming that maybe they don't contain all caffeine, and then they're like, oh, I can take 8 or 10 of these shots and then I'm fine.
Yeah.
Well, like ginseng, right? I mean, you know, it's ancient Chinese remedy, and for most things, you know, there's not a problem. And if I think most of the energy boost I'm getting from these energy shots is from something like that, you're right, I'm going to underplay it. Whereas if I know it's caffeine and we all know teenagers who go out partying are well-educated on the toxic effects of caffeine, I'd be less likely to overdose on these while I'm having my energy boost. But again, I mean, should we maybe just limit the amount of caffeine you're allowed to put into these particular products at all? I mean, we do have certain amounts of limitations, how much alcohol is allowed to be in certain kind of drinks, you know, that sort of thing, right? So maybe we should just say, listen, there's a certain point where it's just sort of stupid amount. So, you know, the energy shots would be allowed to have 1 or 2 cups of coffee or something like that. So like an espresso, right? And volume-wise, they're equivalent to an espresso. So that makes some logical choice. And if you're going to go out there and you're going to mix it with alcohol, well, I mean, how do you limit that? You know, I mean, you could sit there and you could say...
It's pretty hard to legislate that kind of thing. I think, you know, the limit really is ultimately on what the FDA or equivalent organizations put on the actual product. I mean, we can't go by the assumption that someone's going to drink this and then go party, right? We have to assume that the person drinking this is either going to be endangered specifically by that drink.
Well, I understand the Harper government is going to introduce in its next budget leash laws for teenagers.
Really?
Oh, snap.
Nice.
One thing I think that's perhaps interesting too is that most people who drink a lot of energy drinks, at least the people I know, don't just drink them once. It's a regular thing, and I think it can be a hard thing to get over because your body gets used to the caffeine, you don't get the sleep you need, etc. And I don't really think there's any resources or information available out there, especially for young people, say taking degrees, who are not sleeping as they should, to help them kick a caffeine habit should they develop one based on energy drinks or energy shots.
Well, and this might switch the focus of this, but I think this does go into is we spend millions of dollars into education about quote-unquote hard drugs like marijuana and how evil that will do you, and we don't spend nearly anything on trying to educate people on socially accepted drugs. I mean, I think alcohol does get a fair share of, hey, this is what it can do and you should be smart about it, but caffeine, nicotine, you know, a number of the other sort of quote legal drugs. There are a lot of sort of designer drugs like Ritalin and that sort of thing. Well, Ritalin's not really designer drugs, but you know what I mean.
The pharmaceuticals.
Yeah, that are drugs that are common in the community and are used somewhat responsibly, somewhat not. But there isn't the information campaign to say, well, okay, we know you're doing this. And if you're going to do this, you should be aware of this is how you should treat this, because if you do, I mean, anything about, let's say, ecstasy, Special K, any of the other sort of, you know, rave drugs, it's like, don't do it or you will die. When really the message should be, okay, we know you're going to do it. And this is the things you should be aware of, that if you're going to do it, don't add these other particular drugs to your thing. Like, don't have a lot of caffeine with it because you're going to dehydrate yourself and that can kill you. You know, it's sort of the idea of harm reduction, which is a very big issue in skeptic community.
Sure.
Well, and, you know, maybe if people had all the good information, they would still make terrible choices, but we can't have any hope of them making good, healthy choices if they don't have the information. I'm with you 100% on that.
Well, the other aspect to this that you kind of mentioned earlier was the sensation in our society of, you know, the fear of the ingredient. You know, like, I was watching a Dr. Oz program, and by mistake, I actually turned it on. And they were talking about, like, the dangers of energy drinks and caffeine and, you know, oh, this has a scary number attached to it and the name is menacing and it's not natural, apparently. And, you know, it just sort of seems like we are very hypersensitive to ingredients. I mean, we're afraid to drink Diet Cola because of aspartame, you know, and New York City has banned sugar. And, you know, perhaps we can go too far down this road of fear of potentially dangerous substances as long as we're not drinking, you know, enough to kill 50% of the rats.
So, one, it may be a bit of hyperbole when you said they banned sugar from New York. I'm not quite sure if that's 100%
accurate.
No, it's
all the sugar all over New York.
Yeah, they just put it in a big barge and just sank it.
Sent it right down.
Yeah.
But no, you're right, too. And actually, this goes into another sociological issue, is that, you know, as we become more and more sort of modernized and that sort of thing, we get detached from the source of food. You know, again, my grandparents knew the cow that they ate. You know, they knew if they didn't know where beets came from, they could see them in someone else's garden. But now we go to supermarkets and you have all the prepackaged food and you look at the ingredients in the prepackaged food and you are lucky if you can actually identify three things on the ingredient list: beef, monoglutamine hydrolate, carrots, co-narcolithic. I'm not being very creative in my names, but you get my point. So because we literally don't know what we are putting in our mouths and into our bodies, you know, we do get this sort of idea of hypersensitivity. And where I started off with this and where I was worried is we tend to get worried about things that we shouldn't be that worried about. I mean, there are lots of things out there that we don't know, but they're not really things that we should be afraid of. And then there are a number of things that we really should be afraid of, that because we get distracted to the left and to the right, like, for example, all these reports I was reading were focusing on the idea of the energy drink and how horrible it is, when really it didn't seem to be the energy drinks themselves that had any problems. I mean, a lot of them were saying, well, they have a lot of sugar in them and sugar is bad for you. I'm going, you die if you don't have enough sugar in your diet. I mean, that's not quite true. That being said, yes, we do all eat too much sugar, but there are areas that needed to be focused on and other areas that tend not to be focused on. And like the energy shot, I mean, it seems to me that there may be way too much caffeine in these energy shots, and we should actually take a good look at how they are being marketed and how they're being used. But we get distracted by the squirrel, which is monster drinks, which appears not to be any worse than having that super double latte at Starbucks. And it's part of what you were saying is how people just get fearful. And fearfulness is sadly a great way to sell things. It's a great way to get people to click on the link to the CBC and read the article and that sort of thing. And we so easily get distracted by that when we need to be more focused on the particular issue at hand.
Yeah, well, which is why I think that, you know, a particular issue like this one is so tied to the circumstance of which the person is taking an energy drink. Because I find it unlikely that someone is going to literally overdose on caffeine.
Well, and actually, you said it yourself. I mean, perfect example. If I'm sitting there and I'm studying late at night and I've got 2 liters of water and I'm downing like 4 shots of energy shots and I'm just sort of studying, that's probably not a horrible combination. I mean, you're getting a lot of liquid to prevent dehydration. You're having a near fatal amount of caffeine, but not quite enough to keep you going, right? Same situation as you mentioned earlier. I'm going out to play a rigorous game of hockey, and I'm shooting these 5 shots again for I have the energy for the game. Well, you're doing rigorous activity, which is stressful in the body. You're going to be sweating like a pig, and you're going to be losing a lot of water, which is going to amplify the effects. And two, you know, again, it's a physically demanding thing on your heart, and one of the heart's one of the big areas that this actually affects. So yeah, you know, there's a time to use it and a time not to. And again, focusing on the drink and not the conditions, we miss the message.
Yeah. And I think it's especially true because of the connection with the alcohol. I mean, you decide to go out for, you know, a 24-hour party fest with your buddies. And, you know, you pound back a couple energy drinks and then go out and drink way more alcohol than you should. You dehydrate yourself. You're going to be out dancing, running around and acting all young and crazy. And you're putting an incredible amount of stress on your body. And that's what sort of Stephanie was saying. Educating people about these issues seems to be the most effective route to preventing these kinds of incidents from occurring, which we really don't seem to be doing at all.
So, Stephanie, what's the official club position on caffeine? No.
It's very useful during exam period, and I do not intend to quit my caffeine habit.
Well, no, I'm interested. I mean, because the Freethinkers Club has a number of social events,
mm-hmm.
right? I am sure that, you know, me and Ethan are a bit post exam period, mostly, anyhow.
Mm, yeah.
And the partying type thing. So, you know, forgive me, but I assume you're somewhat in the social community at large?
I do try to have a social life. I'm not always successful, but yes.
Okay. So is this, are we just pontificating, or is this like a real thing that people talk about when they go out to parties? Do they sit there and quaff these or not? Or, you know, do they have any awareness of what's going on? And
I think people know what happens, but I think it's the always what people think happens when they're young, which is that, you know, we're young, we're going to live forever, and it doesn't seem like something that could happen to us. It's something you hear about, it doesn't happen to you, it happens to other people. And I think, like I said before, I think the real danger is not necessarily one bad energy drink choice or whatever. It's more the fact that I know a lot of people who are really hooked on these things, and they can't really get off of them. And from a purely educational standpoint, I don't really think it's good or a good way to learn if you're not sleeping properly and you're not taking care of your body. Your studies will suffer for one, but your health will suffer overall.
So how do we reach them?
You
have 3 minutes.
Oh yeah, let me solve the problem of energy drinks. Go. I think that the labeling is a really big issue, right? Because those 4-hour energy drink shots or whatever are really sketchy looking. But people think, oh, I'm just going to have one because, you know, they sell them at 7-Eleven. How bad could they be? I think that's a big problem. If people knew maybe what more was in them, and then you can make those choices. You can say, tonight's going to be a late night and I'm going to do more caffeine. That's probably strictly healthy, but I need to do it because I need to pass this course or whatever. Or I want to do it because of fun, but I know all the risks. You know, people should be allowed to make those risks and totally should make those risks if those are risks they want to make, but they should know what risks they're making. And I think labeling, et cetera, especially because nobody has time to become an expert on how caffeine is metabolized by the body and all the effects. That is just a really high call for ask every single person to, you know, become experts on biological systems like that. Labeling, I think, is really important.
You know, and actually, you know, I think this is another example. Forgive me while I get on my communist horse here, a soapbox. But another way where the market fails.
Right.
Because you would think that if, you know, capitalism really, really worked, it would be a natural fit to have these energy drinks and a 2-liter bottle of water. You know, you sell them as a combo. You know, you charge an extra dollar, and it would be a great, you know, if you're going to have the caffeine drink, you're going to need the water, buy the 2-pack together, and we'll give you a special bonus card or something, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they don't. They just, they the cheapest route available, and they just push it.
Yeah, well, people mm-hmm. don't have perfect access to information, so it can be very challenging.
Yeah.
Well, we are running out of time here on Radio Freethinker. We should go on to our skeptical highlights. Mine this week is for an upcoming lecture, The Science of Harm Reduction Drug Policy, which is very apt considering some of the things we've talked about today. The Science of Harm Reduction Drug Policy with Dr. Thomas Kerr. This is happening on Friday, November 30th at 7 p.m. here at UBC in room A102 of the Buchanan Buildings. It's a talk presented by CFI Vancouver, and Thomas Kerr is the co-director of the Urban Health Research Initiative at the British Columbia Center for the Excellence in HIV/AIDS and an associate professor in the Department of Medicine, Division of AIDS at the University of British Columbia. He's been the principal investigator of several large cohort studies involving people who inject drugs and individuals living with HIV/AIDS and the effects of harm reduction like INSIGHT here in Vancouver. So it's become a very politically charged issue, and we've recently had some big court cases. So I encourage you to come out, learn a lot about harm reduction and sort of the politicalization of this science-based medical policy that I think is something that gets lost in the rhetoric. As I said, the talk is taking place on the 30th, room A102 Buchanan Building. There is a suggested donation of $5 to $10.
Mine is absolutely the opposite of this. It's Nerd Fest, a night of medieval fantasy. Sorry, I thought we had a few heavy topics. Maybe this would be a good...
Awesome.
Yes. So, highlights include live music from local folk metal band.
Scythia.
Sorry, don't chop my head off. Belly dancing by... God, why do they have such weird names? Mahasan Burlesque by Precious Metal. Like that one. Fire dancing. They're going to have a weapon art demonstration where they're going to have people do sword fighting and all that. It's held at the Baltimore Cabaret. That's 2755 Prince Edward. Tickets are $15. It's going to be held November 23rd. Doors open at 6 p.m. Again, go there, have a glass of mead, get all heavy with stuff, the thick, rich beef and meat and mead, and it's going to be fun. Joe,
excellent.
Why not?
Yeah.
My event is the end of life care and assisted suicide event that the UBC Freethinkers are having tomorrow night at 5 p.m. It's in the Swing Building on campus, room 221. We have three different experts to come in and talk about the issue. One to present an overview of different issues regarding end of life and assisted suicide issues. There's one who is, for the issue from the Euthanasia Prevention Coalition of BC, and someone who will speak in favor of various end of life issues from the Department of Philosophy. It's going to be a really good event. The event is free. Lots of Q&A, and should be a good and lively time.
So, Stephanie, while you're here, for any students who are listening right now and who want to get involved with the UBC Freethinkers, what's the best way for them to do that?
The best way for them to do that would be to join our Facebook group, Freethinkers at UBC. If you don't have Facebook, I admire your courage and bravery and a willingness to go alone, but we also have a website, www.ubcfreethinkers.com. And on that website, you can email us for more information, and we update the blog there regularly so that you don't necessarily need to join Facebook, but you'll get more regular updates on the Facebooks for sure.
Join us.
Definitely. And of course, the sense of community and discussion.
And if you like arguing on the internet, there's lots of opportunities in our group to argue. There's a lot of controversial discussions, which I very much appreciate.
I happen to know that skeptics love to argue on the internet.
We don't like to argue at all.
Really?
I contradict your assertion.
Well, we argue on the radio because we're old-fashioned that way. But
no, we don't.
Shut up. All right. Well, this is Ethan, your freethinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
This is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
And this is Stephanie saying it was lovely to be here.
Bye, everybody.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Freethinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The horizon of the Milky Way. The cosmos is full.